It may not be good, but it might be good enough.
That's a new motto.
Advent at Lord of Life. It may not be good, but it's good enough.
It might be. It might be good enough.
It might be good enough. Yeah. All right, well, welcome back to the Beyond Sunday podcast. We're exploring how to take our faith beyond Sunday morning. This is Patrick Nazaroff. With me, as always, Pastor David Bowser.
How are we doing, Patrick?
Great! I answered
David's question. Oh, look at that. I love it.
And Elise McCarter.
Still here. Still pretty successful.
You know, I think, the third host of a podcast that reaches tens of listeners is about as successful, maybe, as anyone could aspire to.
Right. What else could you hope for?
Yes.
It's tens more listeners than I had before I was podcasting.
When you were just shouting into the void.
Yes, that's right.
Yes. Well, happy Advent. Officially Advent. Well, as time of recording, I guess when we released was an Advent this last week.
It was.
So, yeah.
You guys have to argue about what Advent means, right?
No, I know what it means.
I was just Patrick, an argument.
Patrick likes to argue about the validity of Advent.
I just think...
Are you an Advent denier?
No, that this is...
doesn't exist.
This is Christmas time. The world says it's Christmas time.
Yeah, the world also says lots of things that we say are
wrong. Most Protestants say it's Christian time. Christmas time.
It's Christian time.
in the Lutheran church...
It's not just the Lutheran church.
Okay.
It's all sorts of people. Lots of people recognize Advent.
I'm not saying
big fan of Advent calendar with the chocolates in it.
Sure. I just think it's weird that here in the Lutheran Church we sing Christmas songs on Christmas Day and then 2 weeks afterwards.
For the 12 days of Christmas. We sing Christmas.
But that's when everybody else
Christmas
is done with Christmas. You're not really like, hey, it's January 2nd. Who's ready to fire up some Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer?
You don't walk into church on January 2nd and sing Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer either. You're singing Christmas carols.
I'm just saying, at that point, carol time is over.
Here at the Lutheran Church, we have a hard time letting go. So,
yikes.
Thank you. Right. Thank you, Elise.
You're welcome.
All right.
Harsh critic.
That one cut deep.
I was Presbyterian. So.
Yeah, because you guys are great at letting go. It's a real skill set in the Presbyterian church.
We're known for being loose.
Anyway, Elise, you have flown recently in the time of Corona.
Yes.
I have not, Pastor David.
No.
Are you flying anywhere for Christmas?
No.
Me neither.
I jumped off of a thing and fell. Does that count as flying? There's a moment where I thought, maybe I'm just going to fly here. No, fell down to the ground.
Is that real? Or?
I mean, I did jump off of a thing. I was at a playground and jumped off a thing.
Did you fall?
I mean, or gravity.
Okay. Yeah. That's not as funny as I hoped it would be.
In flying, let me ask you here, Elise. Did you have Corona worries about your flight?
Well, yeah, there's that guy who got arrested on her flight.
Yes.
So that was exciting. I don't know that I was really worried any more than I would be being around people in general.
Okay.
Being on an airplane, they make a big stink about how they have this filtration system and less than 0.0003% of particles make it into your breathing space or whatever.
We've got that same filtration system in the church.
Oh,
or at least similar. Not like
you
I'm sure it's not the same thing.
It better because there was a video literally every 2 minutes on that flight about how safe
I was. That's a good idea. We should have 2 minute ad breaks during worship where it puts up how safe the church
is. I have heard that actually being in an airplane
is the safest indoor environment you can be in, has relatively
low risk because they cycle their air so quickly and
you're way high
your vent is like
Corona
directly
can only survive so high off the ground.
I'm not sure that's true.
Sure.
But your vent is literally feet from your face, not in your building. It could be 30 feet away, it cycles pretty quickly. If you're nervous about flying during coronavirus, maybe
what if you're just nervous about flying,
you want to fly, that can't help you that maybe the Emirates Airlines might help you out here.
Sure.
This airline is offering free COVID-19 insurance to all its passengers because if you catch Corona on this flight, they will pay for your funeral.
Wow. How comforting.
Cool. So not your medical treatment, but when you die.
Yeah.
Cool. Now, what do I have to die from COVID, or can I catch COVID, recover, and die 50 years later and still get them to pay for my funeral?
I'm not sure.
I'm sure that they saw through that loophole. They're a major
corporation.
There's no way that I, found a loophole in the scheme.
To get through the system here.
Book a flight, free funeral.
That's right. Yes. Nailed it.
They will cover this insurance, medical expenses, the cost of quarantine, and your funeral if you die.
They do medical expenses.
Yeah. I think those two would probably be what I would be most interested in.
I think of United Arab Emirates, I think of generosity. So I'm not surprised at that.
And I kind of want to make my family pay for my funeral.
No. I'm not even getting life insurance. You're going to pay for this. That's what you're going to do.
Right, yes, exactly.
Yeah, no. I mean, the first two things I would say, like, that sounds more appealing to me than the funeral insurance. I'm dead. What do I care?
Exactly. Yeah.
You know?
Other people have to deal with it.
Now, is this better or worse than the six-hour flight to nowhere that we've previously...
Better.
Yeah.
The six-hour flight to nowhere is one of the dumbest things I've ever heard.
Mm-hmm. And yet, sold out.
Yeah.
So...
people have never ceased to amaze me. Yeah. So...
oh.
Yep. Yeah, so, you know... is there any other insurance you would be asked, you know, you would be like to get in any kind of travel situations? Ooh. Corona or not related? We've gone through turkey insurance. Now we have flight insurance.
Sure, yeah. If I were ever to get on a cruise, mm-hmm. I would want some sort of insurance were I to get some sort of intestinal bug. Because that seems to be
a regular... norovirus insurance, yeah.
Anything like that. Anything that lands me in a bathroom with things coming out in a way they're not supposed to. Yeah, I want insurance against that.
You know, I did have some Corona cruise news, too, that I didn't have not to use, but that cruises are reopening,
yeah,
but passengers are free because you're guinea pigs.
Cool.
Oh.
You have to show up to say, like, I won't get... to test, will you get coronavirus on a cruise?
So I can go for free.
Yes.
And but I can't, like, sue or do anything if I get corona. You
are. I might actually do that. I mean...
you're also probably like, I can
distance on a cruise ship. It'll be fine.
Can you?
I feel like I can.
I mean, if you have a balcony room, you can just sit on your balcony and read.
Do you really want to sit on a balcony for 7 days? Like, that's just...
sounds amazing right now.
Yeah.
In like a 3x5 space? Like, you can't move from that. But what are you going to do when you eat? You got to go to a room where people are coughing all over the sneeze guard things that we've proven don't work at all. Like, yeah.
Wow.
Have you been on a cruise? Let me ask you.
No, I have no interest in going on a cruise, nor do I have an interest in going on a cruise for free during coronavirus. Like,
so
I'd rather go on a six-hour flight to nowhere.
Mini cruises.
Scrooge McCruise.
Mini cruises have a formal dining room that you could go to, like a restaurant, to get your meals. They also have a room service. So
is that formal dining room for me only?
It is not for you only.
Then I'm good.
But they do have, a lot of cruises do have like a buffet area. So that you could go up there.
I'm getting the vibe that David just needs to like charter a catamaran for himself or something to be into this.
Yeah. I would charter a catamaran. Yeah. That'd be cool. Yeah.
Very, very bougie in his cruise requirements.
Who was the celeb who recently like took her whole family to a
that
private
would be,
island?
Kim Kardashian.
Kardashian West, yes.
And like posted a thing about, I just needed this time away. And took her whole family to a private island. Yeah.
Good for her.
I could dig
good
that.
Good for her.
Yeah.
Is it good for her?
Yeah.
I'm glad that she got that time.
Yeah, I was really nervous. You know, the cost of campaigning on the West family was just a little too high.
It is. It's tough.
Yeah.
Campaign life is rough.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. So, any other insurance you would like, you know, in life here?
Life insurance? I don't know.
Well, okay. Life insurance. Yeah, that makes sense.
Can I get like made up insurance?
Yeah, because this seems made up to me.
Can I get an insurance against like the inevitable stupid injury that I'm going to have?
Against yourself?
Yeah.
I'd like to file a claim against myself.
Yeah.
I don't want to file medical insurance for like, hey, I whacked myself in the head with a hammer. Like, I don't want to waste my medical insurance on that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when that happens, inevitably, can I get some sort of insurance for that? Be like Aflac for when I'm an idiot, right? Can
sure.
I get
idiot insurance.
Yeah, can we get idiot insurance?
Yeah, I think that should be a thing. Maybe we can launch that here from the Beyond someday insurance company.
Mm-hmm. Yes, right.
All right, well, let's get back into our main story tonight. We are talking about the Bible again, so we continue our...
first Sunday of the month.
Our trek through
this
the Bible.
This is now our longest standing tradition on the podcast.
Probably. Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, sure, it is now.
Oh, we have to remember our thumb rating for this because we started that.
Right. Yes, so and that today we're actually going to go through two books of the Bible. Okay. So we're going to hit two at once.
We get to rate them independently.
We'll rate them independently. We're going to go through the two lady books of the Bible.
Pretty sure you can't say it like that.
I can and I did. So Ruth and Esther. So the two female-centric books. Now, there are female-centric stories throughout the Bible. I'm going to be honest. Not a lot.
Yeah.
Yep.
Not many.
But these are named for women, mm-hmm. And especially in Ruth. Ruth is the main character. In Esther, I think you can make the argument Esther is not the main character, but...
she's a central character.
She's central to the plot of the Book of Esther.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right, so we're going to go through Ruth first, if that's okay with everybody.
And it doesn't sound like we have a lot of choice.
Yeah, you've got the notes. So.
I do have the notes. So, Ruth, okay, if you're looking at the timeline of Israel, we're going to set these in their time. So, we have Genesis and Abraham and a bunch of, like, really, really old stories in the Bible, a little bit of kind of prehistory right. kind of a yep. thing. Mm-hmm. Then we go into Egypt with Moses, and then Moses leads the Israelites to the Promised Land.
That's Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, Deuteronomy.
Which we covered.
We did. So, mm-hmm. yes. Covered all that.
And then we did not cover these books, but then they kind of conquer the Promised Land in Joshua and Judges.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So there's the Israelites that are living there, and Ruth takes place in the time of Judges.
Right.
Right at the end, before Israel has its first formal king. So this is kind of like, Ruth is kind of like that last hurrah right before we get kings in Israel's history. So that's where Ruth is going to be taking place. All right, and maybe one day we'll get to Joshua and Judges. We'll see.
Yeah.
You know.
There's some good battles in there.
It's interesting.
Those are the man books.
They really are.
The man books.
Yes. For you manly men who are listening to last week's podcast, go read Joshua and Judges.
So. Yes. I read it while I'm shaving. You know, like.
Yeah.
You don't shave.
I don't. So I guess I don't read
That's
it.
A lie.
He doesn't read it.
All right.
It's not a lie.
So Ruth has three main characters, and Ruth and Esther have kind of a central theme that I think is a little interesting to both.
Yeah.
And that is, God is not really mentioned a lot in either of these books, and Esther, not at all.
Yep. In only book of the Bible, God does not make an appearance.
In Ruth, kind of. Like, the characters will talk about God, but the author does not really display God's providence. He's not saying, this is how God is at work.
Or invoke God in any way.
Yeah, it's just kind of, here's God. Like, the character will kind of mention it, but that's it. So it's kind of an interesting thing. And these are also, Ruth especially, is a little bit of slice of life when it comes to what's going on here in Israel times. Yeah, so Ruth has three main characters in it. Naomi, Ruth, and Boaz.
Yeah.
And so those kind of are three. And it's also relatively a short book in the Old Testament.
Yeah, you can read it in a couple minutes.
Yeah, you can definitely read this in one sitting. It is not a big deal.
It's like four or five chapters.
Four chapters.
A couple minutes feels like a stretch.
10 minutes.
Maybe under 15.
Under 15, yeah.
Okay.
Four chapters. It's a pretty short narrative. And yeah, it's a pretty easy read.
It's a good story.
It is a good story.
I mean, there are some things that you're kind of like, I don't know what that means. But, you know, it's a good story. You can get into it even without having the full context.
Is it? So let me ask a question from the scholars in the room, of which I'm not one of them.
We're going to have to go get some scholars and bring them into the room.
Is it possible that these books are written by the same person? Because they have almost the exact same structure and follow a lot of the same principles, like God being a background player, not specifically mentioned. It has the mirroring of and the ironic reversal on both ends. Like, is that possible with the time?
Yeah, so both books would have definitely been edited at one point or another, and potentially could have been edited by a similar author or an author with a similar viewpoint. And so I think there's definitely evidence to suggest that's a possibility, but to say that the same person wrote them both is probably less likely.
There's a massive gap in timeline between these two books. Yeah. Yes. So, and which we'll get into when we get to Esther.
But that, whether or not Ruth, you know, was written in the time when Ruth takes place. I mean, Ruth could have been written much later, even if it was a story that was passed down.
Yeah.
I mean, because there's also this, well, we'll get into Ruth a little bit, but there's this evidence of Ruth kind of pointing towards the King of David. And for that to matter, you really have to have known that David was a king. Like, you wouldn't
the
have
genealogy included at the end is significant.
Right.
Later.
So, so that would move the writing of the Ruth story. Later. Or at least the writing into the version that we have it now. It's probably an oral story that was passed down at some point.
Yeah. So Naomi is kind of our central character to start. Right. And she's going to fade to the back for Ruth and Boaz. Mm-hmm. But she and her family move out of Israel to Moab.
Their first problem.
Yes, they've left Israel. They've
left
moved to
the
Moab, and then their sons have married two Moabites, Ruth and Orpah.
Yeah, Orpah.
Orpah, Ruth and Orpah.
Orpah.
Yes.
No, that's Oprah.
And then all her husband dies, her sons die, and it's just these three widows just hanging out together. And Naomi's like, forget this. I'm going home.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't want to be here anymore. There's nothing for me here.
Yeah.
I'm going home. Back to Israel. And so Ruth and Orpah.
Because there are people who are supposed to take care of her there.
Yes.
Like, there's no one who cares about her in Moab.
Yeah.
There are people who are, like, legally bound, according to Levitical law, to take care of her back in Israel.
So Ruth and Orpah are like, we're going to go with you. This will be great.
Yeah.
And Naomi's like, I don't think you really want to do that. And Orpah's like, you know what? I don't.
You're probably right.
Bye.
I'm on board with not going.
So. Yeah.
But Ruth says, I will go with you, Naomi. And she says this really, really pretty thing of like, hey, where you go, I will go. Your people, my people. Your God, my God. Whatever happens to you is going to happen to me. It's really, really pretty.
We read it at weddings sometimes.
Yeah,
sometimes.
Which I think is funny because it's mother-in-law.
Because it's about a widow talking to her mother-in-law.
Isn't that all the relationship that we have with our mother-in-laws? Isn't it? Mother-in-law? Mother-in-laws?
It is a really pretty...
There it is. Mother-in-law. Yeah,
and it gives us our first clue into who is Ruth, right? Like this, she's a woman of strong character. So they go home, and that's kind of first chapter one.
To Israel.
To Israel, yes. And so chapter two, they're like, hey, we need food. Ruth is going to go out. Find some food.
What are we going to do?
Chapter two, hangry.
Yes. And Naomi is hangry. She changes her name because she's mad.
Hangry. Bitter.
Basically to hangry. Yes. And Ruth's like, okay, I'm going to get some food. So she goes out to the fields and she's just like gathering food from the ground, which is one of the cultural practices of Israel that they do. They let grain fall for widows, orphans, aliens, the poor, for them to gather from the ground.
Yeah, you're not allowed to gather everything. You're supposed, like, when you're going through your fields to gather your crops, you're supposed to leave stuff there. Yes. You're not supposed to take everything. And actually, this is a practice that's kind of coming back in some rural farming communities.
Specifically on the West Coast. I was reading an article about it.
Sounds like a West Coast thing.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, more,
I don't know what that means.
Arguably more friendly to the immigrant on the West Coast than we are maybe out here. Yeah.
I've never lived on the West Coast, so I can't say.
Yeah, I haven't either. I can say, though.
All right. So Ruth is out there. Gathering in Boaz's field, and Boaz takes...
Whoa.
Yeah, our third character.
Slow down.
Boaz takes notice of Ruth and says, who's this girl?
Hi, Ruth.
Yeah.
How are you doing?
Who's this woman gathering...
In a very Joey Tribbiani. How you doing?
I hope that's how it happens.
Boaz, has a little bit of interest in Ruth. Yeah. And he's going to be like, hey, don't go any other fields.
Yeah.
We got you here.
Homie is not subtle about it.
Oh, no. he goes quick. Here. He's like, this is the field to go to.
Yeah. Okay.
Take all the food you need from here. Drink the water that you need. You're going to stay among my field workers and all that stuff. They're never going to touch you. They're going to protect you.
I just
hang
imagine
out here. This is the place to be.
Ruth went home and was like, so a weird thing happened today. There's this dude.
That is kind of what happens.
Yeah, that's exactly what Ruth says. Yeah.
She goes home, tells Naomi what happens, and Naomi's like, Wait, Boaz?
What?
That's a good thing. Boaz is one of Naomi's relatives. And he is this kind of cultural practice, a kinsman redeemer or family redeemer.
At which point, like, angelic noises come in.
Yes.
Just a super weird practice, by the way.
Yes.
To me.
To have angelic noises come in?
Yes. Also, the kinsman redeemer thing.
Oh, right, that part.
Yeah. If you don't know about that, that's for the 21st century listeners.
Yes.
Yeah,
and so kinsman redeemer is kind of this thing, this practice that if one person in a large family or one or two people would have this mantle placed upon them, that if anything happened to family, they would step in and cover it.
Mm-hmm.
And typically this meant if his brother died, his widow, he would take into his family, potentially marry her as well, raise those kids, things like that. So it was kind of this, it's kind of weird from our 21st century American mindset.
But it was kind of an insurance policy.
It was, meant to be their version of flight insurance. That if something bad happened, that the widow or the orphans weren't just abandoned. That they were brought into a new family.
Right.
So it may not make a lot of sense to us, but it does have, I think, at its core... I think some positive things to support
families. There are people who still act this out in some ways today, right? I mean, you have you have family members where parents die and you have godparents who take in the kids. A similar process.
Yeah. Sure.
We don't typically marry our brother's wife if our brother dies. That's not typically our practice. Yeah. But there are ways that we reach out and care for our family members.
Yeah.
All
right. So Naomi's like, this is great. You.
Fabulous.
Boaz is into you. Go get your man.
Go be into Boaz.
Boaz likes you. Great. Go get him.
Yeah.
And so it kind of even says, like, Ruth takes off the morning clothes. And in the early morning, she takes off the clothes of mourning, of weeping as a widow, her widow dress.
Oh.
Puts on a nice dress.
Right.
And is going to go pursue Boaz in the middle of the night.
Sure.
Get it, girl.
On the threshing floor.
So Boaz is asleep and she's going to show up.
After he's been partying.
Yes. Show up. Where he's sleeping, and the Bible has this kind of weird thing. It's kind of says, like, she unfolds the blanket and lays at his feet.
Right.
What that exactly means, it may be a little bit up to the imagination.
It's a family show. We're going to let you discern what you think that means there.
And, you know, we're going to say, I can't say exactly what Ruth and Boaz, you know, what that interaction looked like, but it's a little odd, and it's not just probably...
It's not just your puppy curling up at the foot of your bed.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And so Boaz is like, okay, she likes me too.
I'm sensing something here. Yes.
Yeah, and you know, look, some guys
check
like
yes they, or no.
Some guys need like a pretty obvious sign from the ladies that they're into him.
Yeah.
You know, they're
Boaz
like,
got a pretty obvious
does
sign.
She like me? I think she took off the blanket from my feet. She's into cool. it. She's into me. Yeah. All right, so Boaz is like, great. I like Ruth. Ruth likes me. Let's do this. Yeah. Let's get married. We're gonna have this.
I will be your kinsman and redeemer. I think.
Yes. Yeah. He's like, great, and he even commends Ruth for her character again.
I bet he does.
Very noble.
Yes. And she's a woman of noble character. But there's a problem.
Somebody else
is a closer relative of Naomi. He's the third or fourth cousin.
Yeah.
Whatever that means, you know. And this other person is like the second or third cousin. So, they are closer. So they have technically first right of refusal.
Mm-hmm.
And so Boaz is like...
At the opportunity. Because this would also be an honor thing. This is probably worth noting. Like, you know, in an honor-shame society, right? To be a kinsman redeemer for somebody was a position of honor. So to be able to take some win would elevate you in the eyes of your community. So to take someone in, even as well-intentioned as it would be, but taking that opportunity from someone else would be a form of dishonor. So
Yeah,
it's again
work it out.
A weird practice, but you gotta
So Boaz is like, "Don't worry, Ruth.
I got this.
I'm gonna take care of this."
Yeah.
That's right.
So he goes
to
this guy.
I'm gonna take off my shoes.
This unnamed person.
He does. He takes off his sandals. This
again?
Yeah. In the marketplace, you gotta get there.
Yeah, he goes to this guy and he's like, explains the situation, and the guy's like, "Okay, I think I should step up." He's like, "Oh, but there's a catch. You're gonna have to marry this foreign widow." And he's like, "I don't really want to do that." And Boaz is like, "Don't worry, I will do it.
Yeah.
If you don't want to do it, I'm willing to sacrifice and marry Ruth.
Yes, take one for the team."
Yes. And so he gives him his shoe as kind of this like
takes off his sandals.
Here we go.
Yeah, here's you hold the shoe, and that's
a lot
kind
of
my
feet in this story.
My signature of like this is our agreement.
Yep.
That's an interesting practice. If you like show up and it's like, "Hey,
I want to buy this car.
I got this shoe right here. Trust me, I'm good for it."
Yeah.
But and then he goes back, marries Ruth.
Hooray!
And Naomi's happy. She changes her name again. And then they have a son.
Even better.
Mm-hmm.
And Naomi tells Ruth, "You're better than seven sons."
Yeah.
This widowed...
But also, like, kind of claims the son as her own.
Kind of, a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Naomi's kind of like, "Yeah, this is my baby." Like, not in a weird way, but like...
Yeah, like, I mean,
this is the replacement for the sons that I lost.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, she's pretty affirming of Ruth,
affirming of Ruth.
You know, you were just a foreign bride to my son, but now you're better than any kid I ever could have had on my own. And they have a baby. And that's kind of the end of Ruth. And then it leads in. The ending of Ruth says, and that son, Boaz goes, is Obed.
Mm-hmm.
And that is father of Jesse, who is father of David. So,
oh, bada boom.
And we kind of mentioned early on, if you were listening to this, Abraham and Moses would be two people on the Mount Rushmore of the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. David is 100% the third person on Mount Rushmore.
Yeah.
So he may be, after Moses, Moses and David are probably the two central figures of the Old Testament. So,
for sure.
So this is David's great-grandparents, their love story, how they got together. A little bit of How I Met Your Mother situation. And that's it. That's the Book of Ruth.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. So, any thoughts here on Book of Ruth? Here,
I love Ruth. I love it because it's so approachable. I mean, we talked about it. It's so short and just easy to get into. I love that feature of it. I think it's a great little narrative arc, and I love like the faithfulness that is demonstrated in it. You know, both Boaz stepping into that place and Ruth remaining faithful to Naomi. Like, I love that presentation of the relationship, because it could have gone so many, and in so many other places in scripture, it does go a different direction. I really like that.
Yeah. I think, you know, we'll talk more about Esther in a minute, but like Esther, one of the things is there's a lot of like moral ambiguity in Esther, and Esther and Mordecai in particular kind of presented as like the more like bastions of morality a little bit. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're certainly, I think, morally what you would consider like compromised at that time as well. But it's, you know, God's still working through all that. But then in Ruth is sort of the morally ambiguous one, because she's a Moabite. You know, she's not even an Israelite.
Yep.
And seeing that, like, juxtaposed with Esther, where it's Jewish people in a morally ambiguous situation, or exactly, a morally ambiguous person in, you know, a redeemed situation, I think is really cool.
Yeah, I think, you know, one thing that's helpful to remember, that's a great point, you know, her status as a Moabite, if you're an ancient Israelite hearing the story for the first time, you hear these two Moabite women, and already you're angry that this family left Israel and married Moabite women. And then you hear, oh, well, Naomi's going to come back. Well, those Moabites, they're going to abandon her in a heartbeat. And then the Moabite becomes the heroine of the story. And ultimately, the ancestral line of this king that you know and that you treasure and cherish. And so there's a real elevation of someone who is outside of the clan, if we want to call it that way, outside of the community of Israel, which I think is critical, too. Because at so many points, it seems like Israel is like, hey, this is all about us. And at so many other points, then God is trying to say, hey, no, break this down. This has always been bigger than you. Like, you're my chosen people, but this has always been bigger than you.
Yeah.
Yes. I think Ruth is a really neat story, too. It's kind of like a refreshing take, too, in the Bible, because it's most of the stories we go through sometimes have, like, a sense of epicness to them. They're God at work with these people, and the stakes are, like, so big. Yeah. And then this is just this really personal, really slice-of-life story. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, we know that their son is David's grandfather, but they don't really know that. They're relatively inconsequential people in the life of history, in the life of Israel at that time. Mm-hmm. So it's just kind of these two people who fall in love and have this romantic interaction, and then their great grandkid is really special, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like this really interesting thing. In the book of Matthew, Matthew will give a genealogy of Jesus, and Ruth will make an appearance in that. She's one of four women named in that genealogy. So, and the only foreigner. So, so Ruth is kind of, that's her claim to fame there too, is she's going to make an appearance in the New Testament.
Yeah.
Well, let's get to Esther.
Matthew's genealogy is kind of,
I'd say most of the genealogies, you take it with the grainiest of grains of salt. You know, so
it is not how we think of genealogy, where my grandma sat around for years researching and had everything. Yeah. That's not quite how genealogy works.
He's probably not an ancestry. Throwing names out. Yeah.
That sounds good.
All right, so let's jump to Esther. So Esther took place right before the kings of Israel. Those kings are going to last quite a while. The kingdom of Israel is going to break in half. One part of it's going to be conquered, then the other part lasts a little bit longer, and then it's going to be conquered by Babylon. All right, Babylon's going to take all the Jewish people that are living in Israel and say, like, you're done here, and take them over to Babylon where they're going to live. So probably the most famous book from this section is going to be Daniel. That's, you know, if you're familiar with, like, Sunday school stuff, like Daniel and the Lion's Den, this takes place in Babylon. And then the people of Israel, they'll live there for about 75 years or so. They're going to go back to Israel, and these last kind of two narrative books that we get, Ezra and Nehemiah, are going to rebuild Israel. And Esther is the story of the people who did not go back to Israel from Babylon. So she stayed, her and her people there stayed behind in Babylon, and we're kind of unsure of necessarily, like, when this is. Maybe they're, like, eventually going to go back, or if they're like, we're good here, you know, like,
we've established a life.
We're not really sure, you know, kind of narratively, but that's where this time frame takes place. So if you compare it to Esther, we're talking hundreds of years between these two stories.
Between Ruth and Esther.
Between Ruth and Esther. And Esther is definitely the tail end of the Israel story before we get to the New Testament. So this is, and maybe the last narrative book written. Our timeline-wise, the last one that we get. All right, so set in Babylon, there are four main characters in this one. Mordecai, Esther, the king, and Haman.
You're not going to pronounce the king's name?
Well, how do you pronounce it?
Right?
Xerxes?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just wanted to see if you're going to do it or not.
Yeah, I know how to pronounce it. Yes. Xerxes, yes. So it starts off with the king, and the king is going to play a central character. I think Xerxes is a relatively famous king of Babylon. I don't know if this is the exact same person that you might think of if you hear the name Xerxes.
It's not the guy from 300.
It's not the guy from 300.
If you're thinking of that, it's not that king.
Darn.
But it is a famous, like, in the histories of Babylon. There was a king who was named Xerxes, and so if nothing else, it's pulling from that true historical time period.
So it starts off. Xerxes is in the palace. He's having a party. He's having a really good time, and he's like, "Hey, you know what you guys should check out? My wife."
Like,
drunk as a skunk.
Yes. And he's like, "Let's bring my wife out here. You can all see how pretty she is."
Yeah.
And she's like, "No, I'm not doing that.
I don't want to do that."
Yeah.
And that was just understandable.
Sure.
But he's the king.
Right.
And so he says,
you're not really allowed to say no to the king.
Then we're done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he writes a decree that all men are now the masters of their homes. Yep. Which I'm not sure in the ancient world you really needed to write a decree
it's
about
just
this.
Real petty, but he didn't do that. Yeah.
Have, have you all ever seen the VeggieTales version of this story?
I think so. Yes.
In the VeggieTales version where the wife refuses to make him a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Mm-hmm. Like that's what instigates the whole thing is he asks for a peanut butter and jelly and she's like, no, I'm not going to make you a peanut butter and jelly.
Yes. Love it.
All right, so then we get kind of like our biblical bachelor here, and kind of we don't spend a lot of time on this, but it would be similar to the TV show The Bachelor.
Yeah, it would be.
Yes.
Yeah.
So he has a beauty pageant, and he's going to bring all the prettiest women of Babylon
from the whole kingdom. Yep,
they'll come together, everybody. And he's going to pick who's going to be his wife
after they like compete with each other in a variety of challenges, like obstacle courses and sing-offs.
Yes, he's going to have
chapter was that?
He's going to have a rose ceremony.
Yes.
It's in the midrash. It's in the notes. Yeah. Okay.
Have you ever watched The Bachelor?
No. Why would I have ever watched The Bachelor?
I have watched a handful of episodes of The Bachelorette.
Yeah.
Which is more palatable to me. The Bachelor makes me sad for like most of the women involved. The Bachelorette is like, those guys are just idiots. So I don't care if they're, I don't care if they're looking stupid.
Yeah.
But I feel like it's just exploitative to women. So.
Sure.
All right, but anyway, and it's a little exploitative to women here in Babylon.
It is.
Yes.
So.
But through this contest.
Esther.
We get our namesake.
Yes, Esther, our Jewish woman, enters the beauty pageant and hides the fact that she's Jewish. That they are
First of all, I got a lot of questions about why she wants to marry this dude.
Doesn't want to. Is picked and has said, you're coming to do this.
Right.
She
didn't enter the contest.
It's not a contest that you enter. Somebody went around from village to village and said, you're pretty, you come with me.
Well, that's
you're
nice.
Pretty, you come with me. You're pretty, you come with me.
Yeah.
And so Esther...
It also would be an honor to marry the king. I mean...
Yeah, I mean, you think of like, it's probably not great to marry the king, but your life is probably a lot better. In many ways.
As long as you don't get deposed.
Sure, as long as you don't have to show up at all the parties to show how pretty you are.
Yeah.
So she enters and she wins.
Mm-hmm.
She gets the final rose from...
Fairest of them all.
Yes, the king. So they get married.
She gets a magic mirror in this process too. Yeah.
And then we introduce Esther's uncle Mordecai, who's kind of our third character. And when this is kind of happening and there's this big party, he's walking around and he hears these two guards talk about how they are going to murder the king. They're going to use this opportunity to overthrow the government, murder the king. And Mordecai's like, well, my niece just became queen. I'm not sure about it. I don't think about this.
That seems like a bad idea.
Yeah.
So he warns the king. He sends it up the chain, warns the king. And they're like, thank goodness, Mordecai's a hero. And they call him a hero. And then that kind of settles.
Yeah.
And there we go. All right, so then
that just kind of happens.
Yeah, and then that's kind of it for now. For now.
Yep.
All right, and then our fourth character is introduced, Haman.
Good old Haman. Can I tell a fun story really quick?
You bet.
So the whole book of Esther is kind of the central central background for the Jewish holiday of Purim.
Mm-hmm.
Purim. I never say it right, but Purim.
I'm gonna get there.
Okay. But so one of the practices of reading this, like you read the story on that holiday, and so they'll sit as a congregation in a synagogue and they'll listen to this whole story, and people like boo and hiss anytime they say Haman's name. And I don't know if all congregations do this, but they're like. Congregation, but this is part of the tradition. Like, you read the story, and anytime you hear Haman, you're like, boo! And then anytime you hear Esther, like, yay!
I love it.
Do that now.
I really wish that we did that with, our stories.
It's like a little, I don't know, like the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yeah.
It's like interactive elements for the audience. Exactly. I love it. Yes. I think that's fun, I've never been to that, and I don't really have a strong desire to, but I do like that idea.
I do like the idea of going to something with interaction. That's
All right, so Haman, our villain of the story, makes an appearance. So he... has risen up the ranks of Xerxes' cabinet to kind of be Xerxes' right-hand man. All right, so, and he's kind of there, and he makes a decree.
Like Alexander Hamilton was to George Washington, for the cultural reference of the day. Sure. Right.
Yes. He makes a decree, just like if Xerxes walks to the town, everybody's got to kneel, if Haman walks to the town, everybody got to kneel too.
Also, just like Alexander Hamilton. Right.
So he's walking to the town, people are kneeling, he's, pretty excited that he's out there, pretty proudful. Mordecai sees this guy, and he's like, I don't think so.
Yep. I don't have to kneel this guy.
No, thank you.
You're not king. No, thank you.
Hard pass. Yep.
So Haman is real mad at Mordecai. Mm-hmm. He hates this guy. Who does this Mordecai think he is? He's not kneeling to Haman. So he goes to the king and he's like, Mordecai here, not kneeling. He's causing uproar. He's Jewish. We got to get rid of these Jewish people.
All the Jewish people. Not just Mordecai.
Yeah.
Everybody. Everybody's got to go.
Yeah.
I know we conquered them. We brought them over here. Time's up. Gotta go.
Yep.
And so they're like, the king says, okay, sure, sounds good. So they roll a dice, the purr, which we're, our holiday gets to. They roll the dice and they land on this date. And like, that's the date all the Jewish people will die. Interesting, cool. You know, how they decided on these things. You know?
Yeah, they're not like today. They're not like next Monday. They're like, let's roll dice. Let's see what happens. Yeah.
The subtext, I think, is they're all just sloshed for like most of this, right? Like, yeah. Cersei's
probably
hitting the wine or meat or whatever.
It wasn't safe
hard.
To drink the water, so, you know.
And I mean,
the king is not presented.
Water does the metal.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
In this story, Xerxes is not presented as really a decisive person or like a competent
king. Or even really
king.
A good person. Yeah.
He's kind of just like partying.
He's just there.
He just likes to party, you know? Yeah. And so Naaman is kind of the man behind the scenes. And so
here for a good time, not a long time.
All right, so.
Like King Joffrey from the Game of Thrones. If you want to, lots of references we can make.
Yes, we can keep going.
I mean, you know, Joffrey's kind of an evil person. I'm not sure Xerxes is that.
Well, this is not current, but if you have seen the Disney Robin Hood with the foxes, this reminds me very heavily of Prince John, the lion that's
I
like,
get
Mama!
That. Yes,
you
yes.
Know.
Okay,
yes.
Okay.
Yes.
The lion from Robin Hood.
We'll
I'm
keep,
in.
We'll keep throwing out analogies there.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. All right, so this has been decreed by the king. There's nothing. What can we do?
Everybody's going to get killed.
But then we have Esther. Esther, the Jewish queen, maybe she can save them.
But nobody knows she's Jewish yet.
Right.
But this is a risk because she has to confess that she's Jewish. And the queen can't go to the king with requests or to go talk to them. Only the king can summon her there.
Yep.
So they're like, how do we do this? Do we wait for the king to summon you? Do you have to go to him? And that's a risky thing because time is ticking. And so she goes to Mordecai and is kind of like, what do I do? And Mordecai's like, well, you got to go talk to this king.
Yeah.
And she's like,
otherwise, we're all going to die.
He's like, I don't know about this. And so this is really beautiful part here that Mordecai says. I pulled this quote here. If you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows? Maybe you've come to your royal position for such a time as this. And so even though God is not mentioned in Esther, the author does, I think, ask us, the reader, to find God. Where do we see God's presence here? Because it has a lot. Esther has a lot of like coincidence happening. Mm-hmm. These kind of like things, narratives that build on one another, that maybe God is kind of behind the scenes manipulating. And so we see Mordecai, even though he does not explicitly mention God or Yahweh, a faith that we are going to get saved. I'm not worried about that. You could be the one that saves us, though.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's why you're there. To save us. Maybe this is kind of the divine element. Here you are. All right. So Esther is like,
let's do it.
I'll do it.
But you gotta like pray for me.
Yeah.
And you gotta pray for me.
What happens, happens. We will we'll go through this. So Esther throws a party.
We will roll our own dice of sorts.
Yes. Esther throws a party, invites Haman and the king to this party, and everybody's having fun. She's like, hey, can we meet tomorrow? Maybe let's keep this party going tomorrow.
Yeah.
The three of us, we're going to have a little meeting, powwow together.
Let's take out my like, boat, right?
Let's just go like, the let's do it. You know, she's got a brunch planned for the next day kind of a thing.
Yeah. Mimosas.
Sure. And so everybody's on board. And Haman leaves the party, walking home, probably a little tipsy.
Yeah.
Sees Mordecai. I was like, I hate that guy.
Why is that guy still here?
God, that Mordecai.
That's the worst.
And so he, in a drunken rage, orders some guards, build a giant stake. Tomorrow we're putting that guy on it.
Yeah. Make it real tall.
Yeah, make it real tall. We're impaling Mordecai in the morning. All right, so that's what's going to happen. So not only do we have the die cast against the Israelites, now it's cast against Mordecai. We're right here, the pinnacle moment. What can happen? So the king is a little intoxicated, or a lot intoxicated, we don't know.
Tough to say.
A little sleepless in Seattle.
And he can't sleep. Yep. Yeah, he's just sitting there and he's like, oh, I can't sleep. What do you do in the ancient world when you have insomnia and you can't sleep? He's got, maybe we put on some television, you know, maybe read a book. And he's like, he doesn't have TV, he doesn't really have books. He's like, I'm going to lay here, bring in my aide. They're just going to read to me things that have happened.
Yeah.
Read me the scrolls.
Yeah.
Just put a scroll out, read it for me. You know, we'll see what happens. And so the scroll picked out, coincidentally, that this guy is reading, they tell the story of how Mordecai found out this plot to kill the king.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the king's like, wait, I remember that, kind of. What did we do for that guy?
Yeah.
And they're like, Nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. Thing.
He saved your life and we didn't do anything for him. We just went straight back to the party.
Yeah.
And he's like, okay, we got to do something about this.
Because I'm the king and I'm glad that I'm still alive. Mm-hmm. So let's do something.
That's not cool. With this guy, you saved my life. We got to do something.
Yeah. Also, and in with the in-laws, you know what I'm saying?
Sure.
I guess, I don't know if he knows.
No, he does not know.
Oh, he doesn't?
Mordecai keeps the fact that he's Esther's uncle secret. Nobody knows because
Esther, he's not Esther's Jewish. And they know Mordecai is Jewish.
Yep.
All right, so the next morning, Haman shows up and he's like, all right, got my steak ready for Mordecai.
That's right.
Here for my brunch with the queen and the king. This is going to be good times, good times. Mm-hmm. I'm ready. It's my plot and plan is falling into place. And the king's like, hey, good news. I just found out about this guy who saved my life. And Haman's like, all right, great. And he's like, it's Mordecai. And here's what you're going to do. Put him on the king's horse.
Mm-hmm.
You lead him around town for people to cheer for him.
Yep.
I love it.
And so Haman has to sit there biting his tongue, leading Mordecai around the city with Mordecai getting cheers from the people for saving the king's life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The narrative reveal in this part of the story is particularly delicious because the king just asks Haman, like, hey, what should I do to reward someone that I'm really, really happy with? And Haman, of course, assumes that it's himself. And so Haman comes up with what he should do for Mordecai.
Yeah.
And then Haman becomes the one who has to lead Mordecai. It's just delicious.
It really is. Yeah. This part of the book is very fun.
Yes.
Yeah. Like watching Haman kind of like get
fall
what's
apart.
Going, yeah, fall yeah. apart. Yeah. And so while this is happening,
there's some really good like Disney moronic villain stuff happening here. Yeah. I love it. Yeah.
While this is happening, Esther reveals to the king, she is the Jewish princess.
By the way,
yeah. And Haman is going to not only plan to kill her, but also her uncle who just saved him, who you're honoring on this horse as we speak.
Yep.
And so the king is like, okay, this can't happen.
That's not good.
Yeah.
He's done with Haman at this point. And he's like, you know what?
Ex-nay on the Haman hay.
I see there's this giant stake over there for impaling.
That's convenient. Aww.
Throw Haman up there. So Haman dies a pretty grisly death by his own accord. So we kind of see all of Haman's scheming and plots fall on himself. Like he implodes onto his own self. Mm-hmm. But here's the problem.
Uh-oh.
The king already made the decree that all the Jews would die.
No, the king can't go back.
Yeah, and he doesn't want to look weak, and you can't take back the decree you made. Mm. So he comes up with a new plan. They're like, oh, what can we do? New decree. That date's still going to be out there. It's still going to happen. But all the Jewish people, you can defend yourself and kill anybody who's trying to kill you.
You get to fight back.
Right.
Yeah, you guys get to fight back, and we're cool with it. All right, so that day comes. The Jewish people arm themselves. They kill Haman's family and all his co-conspirators. Mm-hmm. They defend themselves, and everybody's excited and happy. Here we are. A new holiday is formed, Purim,
Yay.
Based off that word dice or die. So this new holiday, Purim, is formed. What do they do on Purim? Do you know?
They read the story of Esther and boo and hiss whenever they say Haman's name. Okay. I don't actually know what they do.
Probably food involved.
Yeah, so certainly. It's a holiday.
It fits. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, I have a holiday. I have food.
There better be.
And then Mordecai is elevated to the king's right-hand man. Mm-hmm. All right, so we kind of, and he takes that place right there. Boom. End of story for
Ta-da.
Esther. Yeah. So Elise kind of picked up on this. You know, in Esther, there's a lot of moral ambiguity here.
Mm-hmm.
Our people that we're following are not necessarily good.
Yeah.
You know, like, we kind of see Esther and Mordecai playing political games, deceit, you know, as part of this, working kind of behind the scenes to scheme and plan. And we could say maybe, like, we like what they're scheming and planning.
Sure.
But it's not done in honest ways, necessarily.
It throws a wrinkle in your moral absolutism, for sure.
Yeah, and it kind of shows us, I think, in Esther, that as we see God at work in here, he's not dependent on followers or people that are morally pure to get across what he desires. In fact, he's even using Mordecai and Esther in their imperfection to bring about a perfect ending as he's going. So even as they're scheming and plotting, God is putting things in place to deliver the Jewish people from Haman. And I would agree with Mordecai here. I don't necessarily think they had to scheme and plot to reach that level. Because I think, like he says, deliverance would come from another place.
Mm-hmm.
But God is using this scheming and plotting to reach that.
Yeah.
So I think it's kind of an interesting thing of like, even in the midst of that, God is working.
Mm-hmm.
Even yeah. So.
It's yeah. interesting. There are some scholars, I don't know a lot, there are some scholars who think the only reason that Esther is still in the Bible is because it's the like foundation for the holiday of Purim.
Yeah,
and they're looking at the story like, this is a great story, but God's not really a central character. It's outside of the normal timeline of the story. There's just a lot of pieces of it. They're like, this probably wouldn't have been considered canonical scripture, except that for the Jewish faith, this is why we celebrate Purim.
Interesting.
And all the other central Jewish holidays are all ordained in scripture, commanded by God.
Okay, so maybe Purim is why we know the story of Esther.
Because
if not for that, it would have been just cast aside. You know, lost to history,
yeah.
like other, plenty of other tales yeah. that they probably told around the campfires, looked up at the night sky.
Like the story of Jesus when he brought little clay birds to life as a boy.
I do not know that one.
That's because it's not in the Bible.
Right.
And maybe it happened, maybe it didn't.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, it's out there. These are stories that were cast like aside by the campfire.
Yeah. You know, so we're not sure. So there we go. Our two female-centric books of the Bible, Ruth and Esther. What do you think?
I love it.
Yeah. Me too.
I think they're both quality books.
Yeah. I think, you know, Esther in particular is kind of a good reminder that life is messy, you know, when it comes down to it. And that's not always necessarily a bad thing, you know, like it's just kind of how it is. And there's still stuff going on behind the scenes. So regardless of human choice.
Yeah. And I don't normally encourage people to take kind of books and isolate them on their own. But I think these are two that you really can kind of isolate. And you can take a lot of valuable pieces about faith and about morality and about interactions with others from these books without knowing the broader context of the story. Like you don't have to know the whole redemptive arc to get a lot out of these stories, where I think you miss a lot in other places if you don't kind of understand where that redemptive arc is going.
Yeah, I agree. These are kind of like in the grand narrative of God and Israel and guiding us towards Jesus. These are two very clear offshoots, in a sense, of that narrative. Mm-hmm. That they're not part of that trajectory.
Right.
And that doesn't mean they're bad or they shouldn't be in the Bible. We shouldn't discuss them. But yeah, I think when you read Exodus or when you get into the Kings, which we may get into, reading them in order really helps understand a lot of things that are happening. But these kind of two slice of life, we're just kind of going off there. It's kind of like, you know, some TV shows will have like this grand arc as they're going. And then like one episode will just be like, what if one character went off and did this?
Yep.
And that's kind of what Esther and Ruth is.
Doesn't advance the narrative at all. But it's, you know, really a great little story.
I was going to say like novellas in like a series of longer novels that are like about side characters. But
yeah. And I think that there's some value there. I was right. So are we ready to make our rankings here for Esther and Ruth?
Get your thumbs
right,
ready.
Thumbs, right?
Two thumbs, so you can do half thumbs. Yes, so you can do zero. It's 0 to 4 is what your ranking could be.
Yeah.
In thumbs, so we're
zero to four.
Well, because you have zero.
Oh,
half you're doing thumb one.
So four halves. Okay.
Yes.
I'll give it 4 half thumbs. All right.
Yes. So all right. So we're gonna start with
ranking. Which one?
We're gonna start with Ruth. Okay. So we covered Ruth first. So what is our ranking of Ruth gonna be? All right. And reveal. I mean, this isn't really exactly exciting for a listening podcast. Right, what is your ranking here, Pastor David?
I'd give it 1.5 thumbs.
Same.
Yeah, me too. I think 1.5 thumbs. I think Ruth. The benefit of Ruth is it's real short. It's four chapters long. You can really just power through that. There's not a lot of wasted time. Mm-hmm. You're not going to be confused.
There's not like 8 chapters of genealogy or anything.
Yeah,
like,
you're like, oh gosh, let's just kind of get through this. It is a brisk story.
Yeah.
It may not be an exciting story, but it is a brisk story. Mm-hmm. And I think it is a beautiful story too. I mean, it is kind of the only like romantic part of the Bible or one of the few handful of like, there's a romance aspect to it.
Yeah.
So I think Ruth, 1.5 stars. Any reasons why you're keeping it from 2 stars?
You know, it's early. I don't want to give out that two stars too soon.
There's a lot that have Jesus in them later on. It feels like we should give the full 2 thumbs to
Jesus. That's true.
Yeah, I would say, I it's a fun read. I think it's a quick read. It has a lot of value in there, but I think because it doesn't necessarily have some of the epic scope of some of the other things, I think it's kind of missing a little bit. And, I also wish a little bit, you spend a little more time with Ruth and Boaz and Naomi, a little more time.
Some more story would have been interesting.
To get to know what's really going on there. It's kind of just, they meet, they fall in love, they get married, boom, you're done.
Yeah.
And maybe there's benefit to that. You get in and you get out. Some of the biblical writers, you don't want to spend more time reading what they say.
Yeah.
So, all right. So Ruth, 1.5 stars. So that's a total of 4.5 thumbs out of... Six. We could have given 6, so that's pretty good rating.
Solid.
All right, let's go to Esther. Again, out of 2 stars, what's your rating here, Pastor David?
A big 1 thumb.
1 thumb.
Oh.
Elise?
I'm going to say 1.5 because of the way it's written.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I also would give it 1.5. And I think it's not quite 2, but it is. I would give it a higher rating than Ruth. I liked Esther more.
Mm-hmm.
I think Esther is just more fun. I think it's funnier. Like, Haman's downfall, I think, is really funny.
Sure,
Watching him craft his own downfall, I do think has something. But it's longer, and I think that is sometimes not... It's not quite as brisk.
Yeah.
And for me, it doesn't have the same... It has a great redemptive quality to it, but it doesn't have the same kind of universal redemptive qualities like Ruth and other things point to.
Yeah.
So
I think that's
for me where the drop comes.
I think if you were going to do a Bible study on one of these two books, you pick Ruth.
Yeah.
If you're reading this just for fun, Esther might be a more interesting story.
Right.
So.
But you also got to jump around a little bit in Esther to get to the interesting parts.
Probably every woman in the church that ever got married had to sit through a Ruth Bible study before she got married. So Esther
listeners,
feels
fresh. If you'd like to get married here at Lord of Life, we will not make you sit through a Bible study on Ruth.
I will say, as the two female centric ones, Ruth... in Ruth, Ruth is the main character. She's front and center. She's in every scene. She's in everything. And Esther, you could make the argument Esther's the fourth character of the Book of Esther.
Yeah.
I mean, like that. But the king, like Xerxes, Mordecai, and Haman are all really more important or more central to the plot of that book. So I think even though it's named for her, she really doesn't have a lot to do in the story.
Yeah.
But her... bravery of revealing that she's Jewish, really, I think we kind of lose a little bit. Like, that is a monumental moment in the story. We know how it's going to end positively, but that is quite a risk that she's willing to do. You know, she could have been killed on the spot, so.
Also, she won a beauty pageant, so.
And she won a beauty pageant, so, yeah. She's brave and beautiful.
Yes. Yeah.
There we go.
The bold and the beautiful.
Yes.
Esther. All right, any last thoughts on these two books?
No, I'm all set.
Okay, there you go.
Well, hey, if you liked what you heard today, go check out Ruth and Esther. Those are available in whatever Bible you have nearby, except ones that only have the New Testament.
Sure.
But can you really even call that a Bible? You just call that the New Testament. So, you know, go and check it out. They're great stories, and let us know what your ratings are. You can send us your thumbs. No, wait. Send us your thumb. Send us your thumb ratings. Don't send us your thumbs. At beyondsundaypodcast@gmail.com, and you can find this and all of our episodes at beyondsundaypodcast.com.
All right, thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back next week with more Beyond Sunday.